You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
This program is brought to you by Jewel, sous vide by Chef Steps. Jewel takes the guesswork out of cooking. Learn more at chefsteps.com/joule.
Hello and welcome to Why Food, a podcast about entrepreneurs, innovators, and career changers. I'm your co-host, Ethan Frisch.
And I'm Jenny Dorsey.
And we have two awesome guests with us today. Lisa Gross, who is the founder and CEO of League of Kitchens, and Afsar Jahan, who's a culinary instructor, also with League of Kitchens. Welcome to Why Food.
Thank you so much for having us.
Tell us a little bit about what League of Kitchens does and what your trajectory has been over the last few years.
Yeah, so the League of Kitchens is an immersive culinary experience in New York City and Los Angeles now, as of last
month. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Where immigrants like Afsari, who are really amazing home cooks, teach cooking classes in their own home kitchens, sharing their family recipes. And also, we actually just started shopping tours, too, which we're slowly rolling out with our instructors, where they take students to their favorite shops and show them what they buy and why. So,
can you tell us what type of cuisines, what type of countries your instructors come from?
So, we have 10 instructors right now in New York. Two in Los Angeles. So our instructors in New York are from Bangladesh, Argentina, Greece, Lebanon, Uzbekistan, Afghanistan, India, Japan. It's a long list.
That's a pretty good list.
Okay, they'll come to me. And I'm just worried that our instructors I'm forgetting are going to be annoyed. They'll come to me. It'll all come up. And then in Los Angeles, we have a Indian instructor and an Armenian Georgian instructor. And we've actually just hired two new people in New York, a woman from Iran and a woman from Iraq, and another woman from Iran in Los Angeles. And we'll be training the three of them in the next few months.
What are the requirements to be an instructor, and how do you pick like the right instructors? Do you tell them what they cook, or they cook what they want?
Right. So we're really looking for someone exceptional. So someone who's not just a good home cook, but someone who really does everything using traditional techniques and methods from scratch, who's a great host, storyteller, very warm, and comfortable hosting groups of American strangers in their homes.
And I'm sorry, how is that?
Yeah, how do you feel?
I love to introduce my country, and my cuisine is from Bangladesh, but it is a North Indian cuisine. Mm-hmm. And I love to host the people. So this is pretty interesting, the different group each and every time. But I enjoy a lot.
I had the pleasure of taking a class in your home a few weeks ago. And I was really struck by, I mean, a lot of things. It was a really fascinating experience. But how little the people in the class knew about Bangladeshi cuisine or even South Asian cuisine writ large. And so you're starting with people who know very little about what you're about to teach them. How do you adjust, because you're obviously an expert in what you do, how do you adjust your expertise to speak to somebody who really doesn't know anything about it at all?
At the beginning, I always ask the student how often they are cooking. So I realize what level I have to start.
Mm-hmm. And is that difficult? Is that something that you've...
Not really, because, you know, the most of the cuisine we teach scratch to finish. So sometimes, you know, they are not familiar with the ingredients, but I have to introduce them step by step so they can easily pick up.
And how did you decide to do this? Where you, I think you don't have a professional culinary background, right? You came from the garment industry. So tell us about the transition, how you became an instructor and why you decided to do this.
Before I moved this country, I used to live in Singapore for 4 years. And when I moved over there, my son was very little, and he's not used to eat that type of food. Our food is a little different. So he always asks me, could you cook for me? And I start cooking. And when I start cooking, my trial and error, everything, I enjoy a lot. Kind of like, you know, the new thing is kind of new invention for me. So that I started. And after that, kind of like, you know, when I take care of my son, I can focus like my full time of job. So I enjoy. And then I was thinking, why I'm not introduce my food to the other people?
Mm-hmm.
So I started little by little do the catering. Like, you know, that some people, they love to eat the home meal cook, but they don't have time.
Yep.
So I started with that. I stay like, you know, half day home. So I use my time, whatever I cook, I share with them. I not really the share, I also sell to them. So like little by little, it is, I stand as a, take as a part-time business.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, kind of like, you know, my background. So I say, why I don't introduce people how to learn my cuisine? So I started teaching with that way.
Can you tell us some of the dishes that you're teaching people, as well as, like, do you teach the history behind these dishes or other parts, aspects of the dishes? Or is it more of a focus on kind of like ingredients and techniques?
Not really. You know, like the League of Kitchen, their goal is not only the food, also the culture. So the first thing, how we live our everyday life. So what is our everyday food? So League of Kitchen, I teach four menu. So two is our everyday menu, and one is our more festive, more rich menu. And other is like, you know, the people, they don't have time. They just want to very fast or quick.
The quick, quick
well, menu. Asari says it's very fast or quick. That's compared to, like, her biryani recipe is the most complex, elaborate recipe you could imagine. There are probably 40 steps to this recipe. It's unbelievable. So her, like, everyday cooking is actually quite involved.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I think, you know, I remember the two instructors that I forgot to mention. They're from Nepal and Mexico. So we actually have a lot of South Asian instructors. We have instructors from Bangladesh, India, and Nepal. And we have another Indian instructor in Los Angeles who's from North Karnataka, and her food's very different. And I've just been so amazed by the complexity and richness of culinary traditions in South Asia and the incredible diversity there. And I mean, Ethan, I'm sure you know all about this, the range of spices that are used and the range of techniques and ways people use spices. You know, mm-hmm. some spices have to be fried in oil. Some are added immediately. Some you add at the end, at the, you know, at the top. And I feel like South Asian cuisine is one in particular that's very difficult to learn from a cookbook mm-hmm. or from a written recipe, that you really need to learn from a person, because there are so many visual, auditory, olfactory cues that you have to follow. And that's what we're all about, you know, the League of Kitchens. It's really about sharing cooking and culinary traditions in a kind of experiential, oral way, which is how cooking has traditionally always been taught.
Yeah.
You know, in families and cultures.
Yeah, it's hard. You can only describe a spice or a taste or a thing so many times without actually tasting it.
Right, and I know for myself, you know, before I started League of Kitchens, I tried to cook South Asian food so many times and failed. And I know for a fact now one of the reasons is because I was always scared to heat the oil or the ghee high enough to fry the spices. Mm-hmm. So I was always worried about burning them, but actually I always undercooked them. And it, and that's like one of those things where when you see someone do it and you're like, whoa, that's really hot. It's really popping and it's making these sounds. Like, okay, I can do this at home. Like,
so tell us more about that process. How did you, where did the idea come from? How did you come to
start
the kitchen?
So the idea came out of my own personal experience that my mom is Korean. She immigrated to the U.S. in the early 70s. My dad is American of Hungarian Jewish descent. And when I was growing up, my Korean grandmother lived with my family and cooked all this amazing Korean food all the time. But whenever I would show interest helping her in the kitchen, she would always say, oh, don't worry about cooking. You should go study. Because studying is more important.
I've heard that before.
I think this is actually a very common immigrant family story. And, you know, I really appreciate where she was coming from. You know, she really wanted me to have educational and professional opportunities that she didn't have. And, you know, and frankly, part of that, too, was she didn't value her own cooking skills and knowledge because it was not valued by her culture, which I think is true around the world.
Yeah.
And it's true partially because it's traditionally, historically, women's labor and domestic labor. And that is a invisible, unseen, undervalued, non-compensated form of labor
in
the world. Yep. Yeah. So I didn't learn to cook from her, and neither did my mother for the same reason. And so later on after college, when I was living alone, actually with my boyfriend and my husband, but like not like on a campus with a cafeteria, and had to cook, you know, I discovered that I really loved cooking and I wanted to cook dishes from my childhood and dishes I loved, and I wanted to cook Korean food. But by that time, my grandmother had passed away. So I tried to teach myself from cookbooks, from the internet, and I couldn't learn from my mom. And nothing really tasted as good as when she made it. You know, it tasted fine, it tasted good, but it wasn't like the amazing flavors that I remembered. And I just realized that so often there are small details and tricks and ways of doing things that you really need to learn from a person and that are usually excluded from written recipes or just difficult to capture in a written recipe. And so that became this fantasy of like, oh, I wish I had another Korean grandmother that I could cook with and learn her family recipes and cook with her in her home kitchen. And so I had that idea in my early 20s, and I kind of just stored that away. And then later on, and probably we'll talk about some of the things I did in between, but I ended up doing an MFA in participatory public art, or what's sometimes called social practice or socially engaged public art. And I was doing a lot of projects involving food. And when I graduated and moved back to New York, I was thinking about what I want to do for my next project, and I was thinking about what I love most about New York or find most interesting about New York. And it's the incredible diversity of the city and that it's statistically right now actually the most diverse place on the planet.
Oh, is it really?
Yep. I know. It's really cool. Yeah. And there are more languages spoken here, by the way, than anywhere else in on the planet.
That's why we're the best city.
Yeah. But one of the things I was thinking was that, you know, there are very few opportunities for meaningful interaction between immigrants and non-immigrants, or even between immigrants from different immigrant groups, you know, and that most interactions are service-based. It's like the person at the bodega or the dry cleaner or the waiter at the restaurant. And so this idea from my early 20s came back to me, and I thought, wow, what if I found amazing home cooks from around the world who could teach people their family recipes in their home kitchens, and that this experience could be just as much about creating an opportunity for meaningful cross-cultural learning, exchange, and connection as it was about cooking and eating. But it would be cooking and eating that would be the catalyst for a certain kind of emotional, relational, cultural experience. So, yeah.
So how do you see the connection between your work in the arts with League of Kitchens? Is this just a big art project? Is everything just a big art project?
Yeah, I mean, the thing about social practice is it's basically blurring the line between life and art, and that anything can be art. But so actually the League of Kitchens, I thought of doing it as a social practice art project in partnership with an arts organization for maybe 3 months. But I thought, you know, this is a cool idea. When I tell people this idea, they like it, but I actually don't know what it would be like to do this, or how it would feel, or how would I find people, or how would this work? So I decided to do a small pilot, which Afsari was part of. She was one of the two instructors who were part of it. Our other instructor, Jeanette, who's from Lebanon, was also part of it and is still working with us. So I connected with them through the Center for Family Life in Sunset Park. They're both part of a catering collective there called Emigre Gourmet. And I basically set up a pilot where they very gamely, and I paid them for their time also, kind of went along with my idea. Basically, I created a small training for them. You know, I had to deal with all these questions like, how long should the workshops be? How many people should be in them? What should be the structure? I realized, oh, it would be helpful probably to have some extra knives and cutting boards and other tools. Basically, through thinking through each step to make it happen, I had to make tons of decisions. And it culminated in each of them teaching either one or two workshops to my friends and family. And I was there. And it was like, wow, this is really cool. And the people, my friends and family who did it, loved it. And I also realized, one, it was a lot of work. It was a lot of work to find them. I contacted a ton of different organizations before I found Afsari and Jeanette. It takes time to train them. Mm-hmm. And I also realized, like, this could be a business. This doesn't have to just be a three-month project that's sort of cool to be a part of and is a flash in the pan. This could be a business that could be much more meaningful and important for the instructors as a meaningful, well-paid part-time work. And then also tons of people could do it, and we could grow over time. And so that's how I decided to start it as a business.
So how have the workshops changed from that pilot, if you can walk us through what one of those workshops looked like, to where they are now?
I mean, it's actually very similar. So we've been open for business for almost 5 years now. It'll be 5 years in February. Ooh. And that pilot was like basically a year before, like 7 or 8 months before that. So I think some of the main changes are, one, we launched just with our immersion workshops, which at that time were 5.5 hours. So I think in the first year we added our Taste of workshops, which are 2.5 hours.
Okay.
Because I realized that there was a whole category of people who really wanted to do this for the experience, but maybe were less interested in the depth of culinary learning in an immersion. They're more interested in the cultural and eating experience.
Yeah.
And or want to spend less money, and or less time. So we created the second offering. And actually in the last year, we shortened our immersion workshops by 1 hour to 4.5 hours from 5.5 hours, because we sort of realized, like, oh, 4.5 hours is still really deep and creates this kind of transformative experience, but people feel less tired at the end of it, which is good. So, but otherwise they've actually skewed very close to that structure that I set up in the pilot.
What are some of the courses that are cooked? And also, like, what are some of the markets that you guys go to?
Yeah, I mean, Afsari can talk about the specific dishes she teaches, but each immersion menu generally has 5 dishes. So it's like a huge feast. And every workshop starts also with a homemade lunch that the instructor prepares.
Wow.
So there's lots of eating, delicious eating. Do you want to talk a little bit about that, Afsari? What are some of the dishes you teach specifically? Or what are the ones the students love?
Like, yeah,
which
your favorites.
Feel like they're most
now
into?
Now the student love more like the spinach with the cottage cheese.
Mm.
So it's called the palak paneer.
Well, I just want to say, actually, Afsari's palak paneer is incredible and unlike any restaurant palak paneer you've ever had, because she makes her own fresh cheese, like fresh. Right there with the students.
Oh, sounds so good.
And she uses fresh spinach. And you realize, like, every restaurant version uses frozen spinach.
Yeah.
Frozen spinach.
And okay, please continue.
I always try to use the fresh ingredients mostly. In my kitchen, I only use the frozen peas. Nothing else.
Frozen peas are a good frozen item.
Yes,
because fresh peas turn not tasty.
Right,
yep.
Right.
So that's why, like, you know, when we finish the dish, the people love to eat that. And also my basic chicken curry, our everyday curry, mm-hmm. I always use the fresh chicken. So it's
like fresh killed chicken.
Fresh killed chicken.
Where do you get this fresh killed chicken?
In my neighborhood, I live Berridge. So in neighborhood, there is so many
halal butchers that have fresh killed chicken.
Oh. They have the fresh killed chicken. And I cook, and I also teach how to cut the chicken.
Yeah, most people don't know how to cut up a whole chicken.
I mean, it's kind of hard.
Yeah.
Not hard, but it's fun.
It can be intimidating. And also, I mean, the way Afsari does it, she uses a cleaver.
Oh, yeah, intimidating.
And also, I mean, one thing I learned from her is that for her chicken curry, she cuts up the chicken into small pieces because so much flavor is released from the cut bone, mm-hmm. from, like, the marrow of the bone. And that's definitely something I learned from her.
So it's kind of like, you know, when we finish the dish, it's so different from the other chicken curry. So all my students, they say, oh, next time we are not buying any more frozen chicken. So this is kind of like that. And another dish we call the gulab jamun, our dessert. Each and every wedding in Southeast Asia, you can find that.
And again, this is like a different animal from your typical Indian restaurant gulab jamun, which usually comes from a can.
So, like, you know, it's, at the beginning, the student are thinking is kind of like the Play-Doh.
Mm-hmm.
And when it finished, one time one of my students, he ate 9 of them. So kind of like, you know, and it's not too sweet, not too greasy, nothing. Kind of like we always focus for the home cooking, more healthy
mm-hmm.
version. So the people love it. And when I start teaching through the League of Kitchen, I can't imagine the people how they love to cook and how they have the knowledge. Sometimes, like, you know, I have to prepare myself what level question I have to answer.
I mean, at this point, Afsari's probably taught somewhere between 400 and 600 people in her home.
That's a lot.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And also, I also teach at the nonprofit culinary institute too. That is
called Rock New York, Restaurant Opportunity Center of New York. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So over there is the different story, right. Kind of like, you know, is more incubator kitchen and League of Kitchen. And I love to teach the people when kind of like, you know, some, not like as a instructor, like kind of a host.
Mm-hmm.
And I learn everything from my mistakes, so I don't want anyone when they left my kitchen repeat the same mistake. So I have a lot of patience to finish. I need to hand each student with me.
Mm.
So this is kind of like, you know, that the different people have the different personality. I want like that. So I don't face any problem, but I love and I enjoy a lot. Like, you know, the 6 student, most of the time, like the 6 background.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes half of my spice, they didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
What is this? What mm-hmm. is that?
What's the popular one that they don't know?
We have the black cardamom.
Uh-huh.
And also the mace.
Mace.
Yeah. Oh, mace, yeah.
The nutmeg flower.
Oh, yeah, uh-huh. This is how I met Ethan, through mace.
Oh, really?
So kind of like, you know, sometimes I try to explain them. I put inside the mess
mm-hmm.
how it's hold the nutmeg.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of like that.
Yeah.
They never think we use that
part of the plant.
But that is more flavorful. Mm-hmm. Like they're very different flavor. Mm-hmm.
And I'm sorry, what did you think of the idea when Lisa approached you with this proposal? What was your first reaction to it?
Definitely, I was so excited. But during the process, like, you know, there were so many trial and error. At the beginning, Lisa don't have any idea how many dish we can fit that time. Mm-hmm. And some dish are more labor intensive, but people are not using for their everyday life. So kind of like, you know, that trial and error.
Figuring out the right menus,
right
for each
menu.
Workshop that'll
sure.
work.
So
the time
kind of like that. So
tweaking and, that.
Yeah. And, you know, the people are, everyone loved to my samosa.
Yeah.
But they try, League of Kitchen try, but it's more labor intensive.
It took
time.
Up so much time to make the samosas in the class that we weren't able to do the number of dishes we wanted.
Yeah.
So I think maybe one day we'll do just like a samosa class
yes.
or something.
Samosa workshop.
Yeah.
What do you think is the biggest thing you've learned from hosting your first class to, you know, many, many classes and students later?
The first class, we are always like, you know, the thinking we are going to finish on time
mm-hmm.
or how we handle, like, you know, 6 different background people. But now, like, you know, like the, after 3 months, we know how we can handle the people. And if we are a little behind, how we can make up that time, who knows? Like mm-hmm. that.
Yeah, I mean, I think all of our instructors are very experienced home cooks and great hosts, but almost none of them have taught cooking before. Afsari is actually the one exception. She had started teaching, I think, in Rock, New York, edible arrangements you were teaching.
No, at the beginning, I teach the back of the kitchen. You see the cumin?
Yeah.
I use each and every cuisine, but very different way.
Mm.
So at the beginning, I teach the Indian cuisine,
oh.
how to blend the spice
uh-huh. oh,
and
cool.
how the like the very common sauce.
So, but besides afsari, none of our instructors have taught cooking before. So we do a very intensive 40-hour paid training to help them learn how to teach cooking, because it's very different to have a time limit and to manage a group and facilitate a group and to even talk while you're cooking.
Yes.
You know, if you've cooked these five dishes 10,000 times, it really takes slowing down to describe what you're doing as you're doing it and explain, you know, it's like these onions we're cooking, cutting, are going to be used for these three dishes, or like this is, you know, so people keep track of it. You know, especially if they've never cooked those dishes before, it can be very confusing when you're cooking five dishes at once.
Yeah. I started teaching plating classes a while ago, and it was like, I learned so much from the first to the now.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people who don't know what you're teaching, you don't even realize what they don't know.
Right.
And you're not vocalizing.
Probably also you don't fully realize what you know. Yeah. Like, that's a big part of our training with our instructors, is getting them to just realize what they know and why they do things, so they can share that with students.
Mm-hmm. Their little tips and tricks.
Right. Yeah. Because they just think certain things are obvious, but then it's like, no, that's a special way or special thing you do. Or like, and then if they, you know, for instance, like our Greek instructor, when she makes her spanakopita, she always cuts it before she puts it in the oven.
Oh.
And I asked her about that, and she was like, oh, you do that so it doesn't crack, because if you cut it after you've baked it, it cracks. I was like, oh, that's really smart. And she's like, doesn't everyone do that? I was like, no, not at all.
We're going to take a quick break, a word from our sponsors, and we'll be back in 2 minutes.
This program is brought to you by Jewel Sous Vide. My name is Katie Mosman Wadler. I'm the executive director of HRN and a real-life Jewel user. I use Jewel to help me host the most delicious dinner parties. When you cook with Jewel, there's zero guesswork. So steak, chicken, seafood, turkey, vegetables, and eggs all come out exactly the way you like them. The Paired app is super intuitive and has a great visual doneness guide. Jewel is awesome for prepping many perfect portions, making it easy to cook for a crowd, and it's hands-free so you can focus on entertaining while Jewel does the work. And pro tip, Jewel is also great for travel. I throw mine in my suitcase if I'm headed to a rental house with any kind of uncertain kitchen. From perfect steak to juicy, tender Thanksgiving turkey, Jewel makes the best food you've ever tasted. Just be sure to save some room for mini jars of pumpkin pie. Jewel, perfect food every time. To get yours, visit chefsteps.com/Jewel and use code HRN, as in Heritage Radio Network, to get $15 off for a limited time. That's chefsteps.com/JOULE, code HRN.
Welcome back. This is Why Food Podcast. I'm your co-host, Jenny Dorsey.
And I'm Ethan Frisch.
Today we have two awesome guests. We have Lisa Gross, who is the founder and CEO of League of Kitchens. And we have Afsari Jahan, who is one of their culinary instructors, and she teaches Bangladeshi cuisine.
So we were just talking about the process of starting League of Kitchens and how it came from, Lisa, from your background in the arts. Why did you decide to, maybe this is a stupid question, why did you decide to turn it into a business? What was the motivation, and why couldn't it just exist as a social practice, art project?
Right. Well, previously, my project before the League of Kitchens was called the Boston Tree Party, and it was this collaborative campaign to plant pairs of heirloom apple trees across Greater Boston, and it was like a big, huge thing. We did lots of events. There were 75 communities participating, 55 sites. I incorporated a small nonprofit to kind of house that project. And so I was thinking that League of Kitchens would be kind of under that umbrella and partnering with an arts organization. But for anyone who has a background in the arts or nonprofits, fundraising,
yes,
writing grants,
like super fun.
You know, huge hassle. And the idea of doing something that would be self-supporting through its main activity was extremely appealing. Because, you know, other projects I'd done just didn't fit into a business model or a fee-for-service model. And so this was a very unusual experience, but it fits into a kind of paid cooking class model.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I guess I just found it really exciting. And also, I always like starting and trying new things. I never run a business before. I had started and run many different kinds of organizations and groups in the past, but never a business. So I was like, okay, well, maybe this is the time. This is it. This is the idea. And yeah, and I basically have just sort of learned step by step.
Yeah, I mean, Agatha and Aaron from Ovenly kind of echo that sentiment where they have a lot of social missions in their business, but ultimately because they have revenue coming in, they don't have to answer to someone else besides themselves.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about how you figured out pricing and revenue and all of that for something that you have never done before?
Yeah, so one of the things I did actually during this period before I did the pilot was I took cooking classes at all of the major cooking schools in New York. and that was really fun, but also incredible research because basically I was in the position of a customer, of a student, and I thought, you know, and I kind of thought of myself as the target audience, like someone who's really interested in food, passionate about food, likes to cook, but isn't necessarily a professional, and isn't interested in unusual food experiences. So I, you know, going to all these cooking schools, basically I just took copious notes about like what I thought they did really well or what I really liked and what I thought could be improved upon. And that really informed my thinking about every aspect of the business.
One of the things that I think is so interesting, but also a little funny about cooking classes is that my sense, maybe you will know this better than I will, but my sense is that people take the class to learn, but maybe are not really replicating those recipes at home. Or there's something about the immersive experience that's really appealing, but very hard to get people to cook those same dishes again in their own homes. Have you seen that? Am I totally off base?
I think there's a range. So I think some people, you're totally right. They're like, that was awesome, delicious. I'm never going to make that dish. But, ooh, I'm interested in mace. Like, I'm going to buy some mace and experiment with it. Or like, oh, I learned how to cut up a chicken. Like, now I'm going to do that. Or I learned if I cut it up into small pieces, all this other flavor is released. So I'm going to do that when the next time I make, like, a chicken braise. I do think it's very common that students pick up tips, ways of doing things, culinary concepts that they use. So I really feel like our classes do teach a lot of practical culinary skills. And some people do cook the dishes from start to finish. And oftentimes they send photos to our instructors or, like, email them questions. And because I do think, you know, our classes also make cuisines that maybe seem intimidating seem much more accessible and familiar, because even though our instructors are exceptional home cooks, they're also ordinary people and home cooks. You know, this isn't like a fancy restaurant chef kind of thing. And, you know, all of our instructors live in very typical New York City apartments, very typical small New York City kitchens, and they make these incredible feasts. So I think that's also very encouraging for people to be like, oh, I don't need some fancy pot or fancy stove to make amazing food. I can use my tiny kitchen to make something great too.
And now I know how to source the ingredients too, if they go on the market.
Yeah, and I do think too, it just, people learn much more about the cuisine. If they travel to that country or go to a restaurant, they also understand it more. One of the things we really emphasize in our classes is how the food is traditionally eaten. So in all of our South Asian classes, for instance, the instructors show the students how to eat the food with their hands. And the food tastes really different when you eat it with your hands than when you eat it with a fork.
It's a different, like, it's a whole different experience.
Yeah. Or just, like, understanding the way food is combined in your mouth. Or, like, these dishes are always on the table together. Because often if you go to a restaurant of an unfamiliar cuisine, you might actually order very oddly. Like, everybody from that culture would, like, order always, like, a sauce and a salad and a rice and a meat and a vegetable. And that's, like, the standard meal. But you might end up ordering, like, two meats, no sauces, no rice, and, like, a vegetable. And to someone from that culture would be like, this is not a meal. This is, like, odd.
This is a hodgepodge.
Right. So, I mean, understanding the philosophical or structural concepts of that cuisine is really a big part of what we do, too.
Yeah, I was just reading about how it's in Somali cuisine, they always serve it with a banana on the side.
Yeah.
And, like, that's a big part of it. And then someone responded, like, what's that banana doing there?
Right.
And people were like, oh, my God, you don't.
So, but it's like that, probably that sweetness and that texture alternated with the food really changes your experience of it than if you don't have it with that banana.
And what else are you hoping that students get out of this beyond specific understandings, either of the cuisine or of the food or culinary techniques? What's the bigger goal?
I think to me, this is all about celebrating and recognizing the incredible knowledge and expertise of immigrants in our culture, particularly, and what they contribute to our food culture, and really humanizing the immigrant experience, which feels so much more important, unfortunately, right now in our current political climate. But, you know, often we get feedback from students like, oh, this part of the world that felt very abstract and distant now actually feels kind of personal and relatable. And like that article I was reading about Bangladesh, that person could be Afzari's cousin or sister, or, you know, oh, I'm, you know, like when we hired our Uzbek instructor, Damira, who's from Samarkand, I had really not thought about Uzbekistan at all. I don't know, in my life, probably. Or maybe like when I learned about the Silk Road in fourth grade or something. But then, you know, getting to know her and her family and cooking with her and going to her shops in Brooklyn and now and hearing her stories of growing up in Samarkand, I'm like, oh, yeah, Samarkand, and like oh, that neighborhood and this neighborhood and that food. And like when I go into these Uzbek shops and I live in Kensington, and there are lots of Uzbek shops, I'm like, oh, yeah, like everything's so familiar to me. And that is just the coolest, best feeling. And I think so powerful and important.
One of the things that I was struck by in the class that I took with Afzari was how much you talked about your family. You talked, you know, when you were explaining how to slice onions or how to rub the spices into the meat, you talked a lot about your mother, the way that you had seen your mother preparing it. And then you pulled up pictures of your son and showed us pictures of his wedding and talked about what he does and his wife. And it turned out that we found out that your son and I went to high school together. that it felt like a very... more than just a class. Yeah. It was really like a sort
very
of,
intimate.
Yeah, very intimate. That's and very much a welcoming into a new family.
Yeah.
Is that something that you do intentionally, or how do you see the way that you communicate with your students about not about the food specifically, but about the bigger the larger context?
You know, when you were in my class that time, the other two students, they came from the New Jersey.
Yeah.
So maybe one of either their daughter or the son, they get married to Asian girl. So they Asian man, boy. And they want to like that. So they just noticed my picture on the wall and they say, oh, you know, your one is more delicate, more things, more that. And I love to introduce, that's why I saw the picture, shared this picture of my son wedding, how different is the outfit, and they need how to do that. That is the one. And also kind of like, you know, when I try to teach the gulab jamun or the rice pudding, how we present that in our wedding or our everyday life. So when we present in front of the bride of the grooms, very traditional way. Lisa had that experience.
Wedding. It was an amazing wedding.
So kind of that. So I have to share to more understanding or more learn from my culture.
Yeah.
So that I love to do. Like, you know, when they show how we do this, how we present this, that is very, very different way. The rice pudding... During the wedding, we present in a big platter with the bridegroom's name. When is the, you know, like the first thing, we give the solid food to the kids. Also, we put in a platter, but in a very different way. We just say, this is your first step for the solid food.
I think that's one of the things that's so special about our classes and our instructors is really getting a chance to learn about the cultural context of food and the traditions and rituals associated with it and people's stories. And it's very different from just going to a restaurant, which is transactional, you know. And this is so much more and so much more about the connection and you know, and like non-exploitative.
Yeah. I also think there's a lot of like seeing that context in this kind of home setting, you learn a lot more about how those people, like, because of their culture, might act in their normal lives, mm-hmm, or how they see, mm-hmm, the world, just like their, right, worldview. I went to Japan a while ago and like understood a lot more about like how Japanese people see the world. Mm-hmm, I was, mm-hmm, like, I see why they interact in this, mm-hmm, way, why, mm-hmm, things are organized, mm-hmm, in a certain way, mm-hmm, why menus are structured a certain way. Yeah. So yeah, I think, yeah, you're a lot more empathetic once you understand, right, why, right, people act, mm-hmm, that in, mm-hmm, certain ways.
It's been such a pleasure having you both join us today. Where can our listeners find out more about you and your work, and, yeah, maybe sign up for a couple of classes?
I want to sign up for
Amsari's apartment.
Please do. And the really cool thing is that each class is totally different because the instructor, the cuisine, the neighborhood,
people,
it's totally different. The people who are there. So leagueofkitchens.com. We're also on Instagram and Facebook, and you can follow us there.
Great. And we'll post links on
our show page. This is so fun.
Thanks to Red Blind by the Red Crickets, which is our theme song, and Noam, our awesome engineer. And
as always, you can always find us on at Why Food Podcast. And if you have questions, comments, thoughts, nominations on other guests, please email us whyfood@heritageradionetwork.org.
And you can find me via my spice company on social media, Burlap and Barrel.
And I'm at Chef Jenny Dorsey. Thank you all, and see you next week.
See you soon. To a place that only I can know. That's why we ended
up like that. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.